cover a few things from the coming Sedra. The Sedra starts at Chem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. This idea of all of Klal Yisrael together, and then it delineates Rosheichem, Shivteichem, all the different people and Tafkidim. That what is the word in English?
Jobs,
occupations. It's not. There's a better word for it.
Okay, but anyway. Word.
What?
It's really words. Jobs.
Huh?
Duties.
Yeah. Okay. Functions.
A functionary.
Okay.
And there are svarim that say that there's a hint here to Rosh Hashanah. Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem is everybody standing in judgment. And it's significant that it speaks about everybody together and everyone separately. Because it says in the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, that on Rosh Hashanah kol bo'ei olam ovrim lefanav kibnei maron. On Rosh Hashanah, all human beings pass before God like bnei maron. And the Gemara says three different explanations what that means, but they all boil down to the same idea, single file. Like sheep, the shepherd counts each one separately and counts them and reviews them one by one. Or like people climbing up a narrow staircase, one by one, single file. Or like soldiers being reviewed by the king, one by one, single file. And then the Mishnah says, the kulam niskarim b'skira achas. And then they're all looked upon with one glance. So in my estimation, what that means is the following. There are two aspects of the judgment of Rosh Hashanah. One, we're going to be judged as individuals. Single file, everybody, each man for himself, each woman for herself, everybody judged as a individual, single file. And then there's going to be another judgment, and that is, how do you fit into the community? You may be great sheep, great climber, great soldier, but do you interact with all the other sheep? Are you a lone sheep, or are you part of the flock? Are you a person who's climbing the staircase and totally oblivious of all the other people on the staircase, or do you take them in consideration? Are you a nice soldier, but you don't know there's an army? You're just doing your thing. So God's going to judge us on a second level as part of the community. And there are many different communities. Everybody lives in many communities. The first community is your immediate family. Parents, children, siblings. Then there's the extended family, aunts, uncles, cousins. That's another community that you have to interact with. And then there is your neighborhood, your shul, your city, your country, your Klal Yisrael, the world. So we, at the same time, exist in many, many different communities. And there are three aspects of community. We've mentioned this before, I'm going to just mention it in passing. There's Kahal, Adas, Yisrael. Kahal literally means a congregation. Vayikohalu ha-Yehudim. It means to congregate in one place. People are united by the fact that they're all in the same place and doing things together. That's a Kahal. So you're going to be judged, do you do mitzvahs together with other people, or do you do them as a loner? Do you come and daven with a minion? Do you go and learn at a shir? But everything you do on your own. What's the difference? The difference is, there's no comparison of an individual doing mitzvahs and the power of numbers. There's more honor to the Ribbono Shel Olam when more people do the mitzvah together. And therefore, the question is going to be asked, do you interact well, and do you work together with the various communities that you live in? The second thing is an Eda. Eda, Rav Shlomo Shmuel von Hirsch, I think, says, comes from the word edus, to testify. That it doesn't have to be that everybody's gathered together in one place, but what unites them is the fact that they all testify to the same goals, principles, beliefs and so on. They can be scattered along the around the world, but they're united in their edus. So they're an Eda. I think that Eda comes from a different word. In the airport, if you look up at the big board in Ben Gurion, so where it says in English destination, it says in Hebrew Yaad. Eda means that everybody has the same destination. They're all going the same place. That's what unites them. They may not be on the same plane or whatever, but they're all going the same place. So that's an Eda. And they unfortunately they were. The ten of them had one common purpose, which was bad. Eda Hara Hazeh. And that's why Yehoshua and Caleb weren't included. Right? They weren't going the same place. That's why Adas Korach also, they also ended up in the same place. And the Israel is like we've explained many times. Yeshishim ribui osios la Torah. There's 600,000 letters to the Torah. Just like there, every letter in the Torah is unique. Every Jew is unique, and Jews are like letters in the Torah. And just like a letter in the Torah could be a beautiful letter, but if it's in the wrong place, it passes up the whole Sefer Torah. So too, a person can be doing his individual thing beautifully, but if he doesn't coordinate it with everybody else, something's wrong. So therefore, on Rosh Hashanah, there's two judgments. There's the individual judgment, and then there's the Tzibur judgment. And we speak about it in Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. It says that, what's it called, every person, Maisa Ishu Pekudaso, and then Al Hamedinos Bo Ye Omer, there's a general, right, collective judgment. And I think that's why the Rambam says that Yom Kippur, whose man kapara, zman tshuva liyachid ulerabi, it's the time, the deadline for tshuva, for the individual and for the community, because there's two judgments. There's the individual and there's the community judgment. And it could be the Rambam also says the following. He says that's why during Aseret Yemei Tshuva, Noagu Kol Beis Yisrael, all of the household of Klal Yisrael have the custom, Laharbos Mitzvos Ubitztaka, to do extra mitzvahs during Aseret Yemei Tshuva and more tzedakah, because since we're being judged and every mitzvah counts, and it depends how the scales, you know, which side weighs out the other side. So that's why the custom is to do a lot of extra mitzvahs and give a lot of extra tzedakah during Aseret Yemei Tshuva. And then the Rambam continues, the Nohagu Kulam, and all of them have the custom to get up at night and go to shul and daven till the early morning. Slichas. So he's bothered me. Why is the Rambam split it into two things? He should have said, V'lochein, therefore, Nohagu Kol Beis Yisrael, Laharbos B'mitzvos, U'laharbos Tzedakah, and to go to shul at night and get up and daven till early in the morning. Why did he split it into two things? Noagu Kol Beis Yisrael, mitzvahs and tzedakah, and then again he says, V'noagu Kulam, because what he's telling us is the following. As an individual, what's going to promote a good judgment for you? Do more mitzvahs. Give more tzedakah. That's an individual thing. But what's going to promote your communal judgment? That you have to do something as a community. So therefore they instituted slichos. Slichos, most of them you can't say, the main ones you can't say alone. You have to have a minyan. That's what the Rambam says. Not that people get up and daven. They go to shul. They go bote kinesios as a tzibur. And they daven slichos. That is what promotes and enhances the communal judgment. So that's the idea of Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. You're all standing before Hashem. And it hints to Rosh Hashanah. And therefore it speaks about the tzibur. And it also speaks about each individual and his specific mission and function and tafkid. There's another reason, though, why it mentions Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem. The thinkers of Simcha Zissel from Kelim says that the greatest schus a person can have to be able to face the judgment on Rosh Hashanah is to be a person who people need. Because then when you're judged, you're not judged on your merit alone. You're judged on other people's merit too. For instance, a person every day goes to the local makolet and buys groceries for a widow, right, an elderly widow who can't get out of the house. And she's counting on him. Right? He's not there. She doesn't have her groceries. And she's a nice little old lady, like Sadekis, right? And he's not such a great guy. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu now judges the guy in Rosh Hashanah, and he says, hey, this guy, you know, really doesn't deserve a good judgment. But what am I going to do? Right? That old lady needs him. And if I do something to him, right, she's going to suffer. She doesn't deserve to suffer. So either the Rabbanim will find a replacement for him, or he will give him a good judgment because somebody else needs him. And therefore, the more people that need you, the better chance you have of coming out of the judgment of Rosh Hashanah in a positive way. So the best way of dealing with the Mishpat of Rosh Hashanah is to be a person shat shibur tzrichim lo, that the community needs you. You're a person who does things for the community, and the community needs you. The more people that need you, the better off you are. A third reason why Rosh Hashanah is hinted to with this collective and individual is because because the following. It says that on Rosh Hashanah we don't say Hallel, because the mood is a much more somber mood. It's not a joyous, rejoicing mood to say Hallel. So Rosh Hashanah Kippur. Because Sifrei Chaim, the Sifrei Mesim, Psuchim Lefanav, the books of life and death are open before God. Right? How can you say Hallel? It always bothered me. It should have said that the books of death are open. That's what scares me. The books of life don't scare me that much. But the answer is no. The books of life are also open. And the Chofetz Chaim says somebody who's afraid to live is not going to be afraid to die. Somebody who's not afraid to live has a lot to be afraid of about dying. So the books of life also somber you to know if you're living properly. Not just what may happen to you if you don't survive. What's going to be with you if you do survive? Right? How are you leading your life properly? In any case. And then on the other hand, it says that we get dressed up in yontif clothing and we eat and we drink on Rosh Hashanah, and we are confident that God will bring out our judgment for the good. So which is it? Are we confident? Or are we in trepidation, and therefore we don't say Hallel because the mood is supposed to be a very serious, somber mood because the books of life and death are open? So one answer they say is that somebody who is somber and realizes and takes it seriously, he can be confident that everything's going to be okay. So they go together. Right? If you know that you have the right attitude, then you can be confident too. Another answer they say was the following. As individuals, we don't know what's going to be. Right? We have no guarantees. But as Klal Yisrael, as the nation, right, there we can be confident that the judgment of Klal Yisrael is going to come out okay. Because in the end, God does miracles for the survival of the Jewish people. And that's why existential threats to the Jewish people are not as serious as threats to individuals or to parts of the Jewish people. When Haman wanted to destroy everybody, Mordechai told Esther, look, you have an opportunity now to go to the king and to be involved in saving the Jewish people. But if you don't do that, then salvation will come from somewhere else. How is he so sure? Maybe it hinged on her. He said, because this is an existential threat. Right? He wants to destroy everybody. That can't be. Lo yitosh Hashem amo v'nachlaso. That can't be. So if you want to do it, you'll get the credit. If you don't want to do it, somebody else is going to do it. But where it's only a threat to parts of the Jewish people, whatever, there it's much more serious. So as individuals, the mood is very somber. But as Klal Yisrael, with an upbeat mood, we eat, we drink, get dressed nicely, take a haircut before Yontif, in confidence that the Tzibur is going to come out okay. Okay. Next, let's go to something else. It says that somebody hears the covenant that's being made, and they all had to accept upon themselves the entire Torah for themselves and for all future generations. Somebody said, you know what, I'm really not really accepting this. I'll go along with everybody else, but I can do whatever I want, and everything will be okay. And he doesn't accept this covenant. So then it says, Lo yoga Hashem sloach lo. God won't forgive him. And it says that, what's it called? He's called a shoresh pore rosh velano, a root that grows into a poisonous bitter root. So first, let's discuss that shoresh pore rosh velano. It's an interesting idea, and that is, this person hasn't done anything wrong. He's just had this really bad idea of not accepting the covenant on himself, and separating himself from the community only in thought. That's created a root. Nothing's happened yet, but that root passes on to his children. And if the children decide to uproot it and start again, plant another root, fine, they're not affected by it at all. But if they choose to nurture it and to continue on that feeling, then in the next generation, it's not a root anymore. Now it develops into a sapling. Now the next generation already inherits a sapling, right? The seed. If they decide to uproot it, they can. But if they decide to nurture it, it grows into a tree. And by the next generation, it's a giant redwood. And that's why it says, Poked avon avos albonim, the albanei banim, there are certain sins that the Gemara says, Och sin masi abosein biyadeim, where children hold on to the sins of the parents in their hands. In other words, they continue those same sins and nurture them. So then they pass down by spiritual heredity. Right? They don't have to remain. A person has the ability to uproot them, to negate them, to cleanse himself of them. Right? It may be a little more difficult because he was brought up and the parents had that sin or whatever. No, that's his nisayon in this world. Right? But it's not impossible. And therefore, if he decides to uproot it, negate it, get rid of it, no problem. If he decides to nurture it and continue it, that's why it's not a good idea to continue the sins your parents did. If you want to do sins, do new ones. But don't do the ones your parents and grandparents did, because it compounds the sin. And that's the idea. The Gemara says, it says, Ish b'cheto yumoso. People get punished and die for their own sins. And here it says that poked avon avos avon, people getting punished for the parents' sin. So the Gemara answers, Kan kishaolzim maisei avosim biyadeyam, the kan she'ein moksim. Where they hold on to the parents' sins in their hand, literally, right, then they're punished for the parents' sins. Because it's not that they're being punished for what the parents did, but the parents gave over to them already a mature sin. So when they do it, it's much more serious, much more compounded than it was done in the previous generation. And it compounds itself generation after generation until there's no more hope. So that's what it says, Shoret Poret Rosh Velano. It's a root. It could start with just a little root in the mind of one generation, but then it goes on to the next generation. It becomes rooted in the psyche of the next generation, becomes more actions and more actions or whatever. And if nobody decides to let go of it and uproot it, it's compounded throughout generations.
Does it speak about Avodah Zarah or any other?
It's more specifically to Avodah Zarah. Let's convince ourselves that it applies. The Rambam says only applies to Avodah Zarah, but the others say that it applies to any sin. Okay, in any case, that's one. It could be that which it says, that after four generations the family is destroyed, only applies to Avodah Zarah. The second part of the pasuk says, "Leman spos harava es hatzmei," and the literal translation is that the quenched will overtake the thirsty, which just sounds like double talk. So there are a few different ideas. I'll tell you two of them. One is like this: quenched means sins that a person does without intention. He doesn't do them on purpose. He made a mistake. He thought it was Friday. It was really Shabbos. Right? So he didn't do the Aveira with a great thirst with the Yetzer Hara. It was a quenched Aveira. And the thirst is when you do the Aveira with a intention. You want to do it, whatever, with a desire. Usually people don't get punished for aveiras that are done without any desire. You did them by accident, you did them unintentionally. There are certain aveiras that if you're doing them unintentionally, there's also you have to bring a sacrifice or whatever because you weren't careful enough, but you surely don't get punished as if you did it on purpose. However, what happens if you don't accept the Torah at all? Okay? And if you had, when you knew it was Shabbos, you'd be Mechal Shabbos. Except you thought it was Friday. So when you did this thing, you did it on Friday, right? But if it would have been Shabbos, you wouldn't do it on Shabbos too. So that, you don't have the, you thought it was Shabbos, but it wasn't. It was just Friday. You're going to get punished for what's it called, for being Mechal Shabbos, as if you did it on purpose. Why? Because the fact that you didn't know doesn't make a difference at all. Even if it would really be Shabbos, you know it's Shabbos, so do it. Right? Knowing it was Shabbos wouldn't stop you. So thinking it was Friday and doing it because it's Friday would not have stopped you had you known it was Shabbos. Therefore, there's no shogeg. So when a person gives up total abandon and he's not interested in keeping anything, then he's not only going to be punished for the things he does willingly, even the things he does by unintentionally he's going to be punished for. Because even if he would have known, he would have done it anyway. So you can't say, well, I didn't know. Well, you didn't know. If he would have known, it made a difference. That's one meaning. Another meaning is like this. When a person gives up total abandon and he lets himself be the victim or the object of his desires, he just does whatever he wants. What that usually leads to is familiarity breeds contempt, which means the following, that if you give in to your desires too much, then they become hackneyed and commonplace, and they don't give you the thrill that you want. You're looking for thrills. You're looking for satisfying your desires. And when the desires are done over and over, they don't provide you with what you need. That's why there's a drug culture, right? Because people just do whatever they want. There's nothing stopping them. And therefore, in order to have a thrill in this world, they have to create a fantasy world, right? And give themselves things that are not normal to be able to satisfy their desire for pleasure. Because the normal things don't give them pleasure anymore. I became very aware of this very young, this idea. When I was about 6-7 years old, and I remember the name of the guy, Michael Todd was the, producer of Around the World in 80 Days. It was one of those spectacular movies, right? A cast of thousands and and a budget of who knows how much. When they finished the movie, so he threw a gala party for all of Hollywood to celebrate, right? The man was obviously a rich man. He threw this gala party. Okay. That was his name was Michael Todd, I think. Yeah, Michael Todd, yeah. So in any case, so he threw this gala party. And this was, must have been seven years old, in the early 1950s. So I remember we had this black and white television, okay, in a mahogany thing with a screen that, you know, today is smaller than what's on an iPhone or whatever. And it was all black and white. And I remember that they were showing this party on television. And as I can remember, as a six-year-old, I was watching this. And it was really intriguing, like this gigantic party and all these tables of food or whatever. And then they said that one of the tables of food, which is one of the entrees, was chocolate-covered ants. You know, ants, little sick-legged creatures. Not the female variety, right? Yeah, right.
Not the kosher.
Right. Big. And I remember thinking to myself as a six-year-old, Nebuch, the guy must have run out of money. They had to go collecting ants, right, because they had nothing else to eat. And they invited all these people to the party and fed them ants. Now, why in the world were they eating chocolate-covered ants? Right? I mean, no, you can't tell me that somebody walks into their kitchen and sees an ant infestation and says, wow, lunch! You know, when he goes to get the ant spray. Nobody in their right mind looks at the ants. Right? Eat with the chocolate. You can eat the chocolate out of the ants. Right. Go get the chocolate, right? Get the butterscotch, you know, what's it called? Let's pour them over the ants. There's nobody in their right mind does that. But when you give in to all of your desires, nothing excites you. So you got to look for things that are not normal. So the normal things, the things that you're what's it called, thirsty for, don't give you the excitement anymore. So then you have to go after the things that normally people's desires are quenched to them. They're not interested in that. They don't even think about it. Right? But if you think about all the crazy things that people do, right, just for thrills, because they don't have the normal things in life have become so commonplace that they don't give them pleasure anymore. So that's what it also means. When you give up, abandon yourself to satisfy your desire, and there's no control, then the mansfos harava satsmeya, the quench things overtake the things that you're normally thirsty for. Now you're going to be thirsty for the things that people are normally, their desires are quenched for. Okay, another one or two things. Okay, it says that Torah is not far from you, but it's beficha uvilvavcha lasoso. It's in your mouth and your heart to do. So if you'd ask me to put those three things in an order, that wouldn't be the order. I wouldn't start with speech, thought, action. I would rather start with thought, speech, action. Going from the more ethereal to the more temporal and physical. Or the opposite. I would go from action, speech, thought. The other way around. Right? But the simple idea is, first you think, then you speak, and then you do. So why did the Torah put it in the other order? I saw an interesting Ibn Ezra just the other day that answers the question. He says the central point of Judaism is your heart. What you really feel, what you really in your heart. Except you just can't, you know, put things in your heart by downloading them. So how do you do it? Either by speaking or by acting. So the speech and the act are the crutches on the side, but the midpoint of what you're supposed to gain from the things you're supposed to speak. There's a lot of things that we have mitzvahs to say. Learning Torah, davening, right, the Seder Pesach, whatever it may be. And then there's mitzvah things to do. But the purpose of them is not just to do and say, but it should go into your heart. The speech and the action work on bringing it to your heart. So the central point is the heart, the thought. But the way to get it is one side from speech and the other side from action. That's Ibn Ezra. I have a different idea. And that's the following. We know that there's the idea of Chochmah, Bina, and Das. Chochmah is facts. Right? Getting a database. Knowing the facts. Bina is being able to take those facts and understand them, what their implications are, and build on them. And Das is the application of that into the real, actual, physical world. That's Das. Das is a connection. So, it works like this. When a person has an initial thought, okay, it's not really defined. It's like they have in the comic books, a light bulb lights up above your head, right? It's a, you have this hashra'ah, this, what's it called, revelation, right, of a thought. And you don't really know, you just have this idea, but it's not defined. How do you define it? By speaking it out. Now you speak it out. So let's put the, and define this idea. At that point, it becomes chokhmah. It becomes, in fact, details. After you spoke it out, now you can deal with it as thought and build on it, understand its implications or whatever. So everything really starts with this ethereal revelation, but that doesn't count. Because if you leave it at that, it's meaningless. So you first have to translate it into speech, which means that you now state the facts, define them, crystallize the idea. Then once you have spoken out the idea and you have the facts, now you can take it to your heart and think about it and understand its implications and whatever. And then you can put it into action. So really it starts with Ficha, then Bilvavcha, then Lasoso, and that's Chochmah, Bina, and Das. And the truth is, that's how the Yomim Tovim go. Pesach is speech. You talk. You get the facts. God took us out of Egypt. He's a God. We believe in him, whatever. The more you talk, the more you define the facts. Shavuos, there's no talking and there's no doing. You're thinking, you're accepting the Torah. Okay, if this is the facts, and God is there and he's concerned with us and he took us out of Egypt, then we have the implications. We better do what he wants. Accept his Torah. So that's Kabbalah Satorah. That's in the heart. And then Sukkot is putting it into action. Yes, we can live in Sukkot and Korbanos and so many things that we do on Sukkot. So really, Sukkot should come right after Shavuos. Right? After you have the Chachma, then you have the Bina, now you can have the Das. There's only one problem. After Shavuos, we sin with the golden calf, and we blemish the Chachma we got on Pesach, and the Bina we got on Shavuos. So we need something to compensate and to correct what was lost, because you can't have Das if you don't have the Chochmah and the Bina first. So Sukkot had to be pushed off, and there were two other Yomim Tovim that may not have been added but took on a new aspect of complementing, supplementing and correcting what was lost on Pesach and Shavuos. The first one was called Rosh Hashanah, which also we mostly speak. It's Malchiyah, Zichron the Shofar, and Blow the Shofar. We use our mouth, Picha. So Rosh Hashanah corrects what was lost from Pesach. Yom Kippur is when we got the Torah a second time. And it's mostly in the heart. Regretting your sins, doing tshuva is mostly in the heart. So Yom Kippur takes the place of Shavuos, or corrects what was lost on Shavuos, and now we re-accept the Torah. Just like then, we accepted it, but it was blemished. Now that you have those two Yomim Tovim to correct what was lost from the Chochma of Pesach and the Bina of Yom Kippur, of Shavuos, now you can have Sukkot. That's why Sukkot follows Yom Kippur and doesn't come immediately after Shavuos. Okay.